So turn with me tonight to Job chapter 6. Job chapter 6, once again, we are making our way through this chapter, and our study tonight picks up at verse 15. As you'll recall, Job is responding here to Eliphaz's attempt to encourage him. Eliphaz has made a somewhat rambling speech, recorded in chapters 4 and 5, and in his mind at least, it's clear that he believed his speech to be well-researched and based on incontrovertible facts, not just about mankind in general, but about Job's situation in particular. In verses 1 to 14 of this sixth chapter, having waited patiently for Eliphaz to finish his speech, Job explained that in light of everything that had befallen him, it was perfectly reasonable that he had responded in the way that he had. After all, he had not gone to the extent of speaking ill of God himself. It was simply that in his current predicament, he would just as soon have not been born at all. In fact, as he said in verse 10, "It is still my consolation, and I rejoice in unsparing pain that I have not denied the words of the Holy One." He went on to remind Eliphaz that his strength was not that of stones, nor was his flesh as hardened bronze. Day by day, and with each successive blow, it was as if any hope of deliverance was quickly fading. And we can certainly appreciate that, can we not? You know, none of us have experienced the type of suffering that Job was going through, but we can at least sympathize with him to the extent that if we were in his shoes, we might very well act in the same way that he did. We might very well say some of the same things that he did. This is all Job's saying. He's saying, look, my response to my suffering is not without merit. You suffer in the same way I've suffered, and you'll act the same way. If you were to put my suffering on the scale, he said, and weigh the way I'm behaving with the amount of suffering I'm enduring, you might find out that it's perfectly balanced. I have every reason, he says, to respond in the way I'm responding as a mere mortal human. Then in verse 14, Job chastises Eliphaz, saying, "For the despairing man, there should be kindness from his friend so that he does not forsake the fear of the Almighty." It's obvious at this point that Job considered Eliphaz's attempt at encouragement to be just the opposite. In truth, Job considered Eliphaz's words to be an unwarranted personal attack on his credibility and his reputation as a God-fearing man. It's almost as if Job's saying, look, you know the type of man that I am. You know the type of man that I've been. Give me a break. Cut me some slack, as it were. Now, here in verse 15 of our text, Job turns his attention away from Eliphaz in particular and onto all of his friends, all three of them who had come ostensibly to console and comfort him in his suffering. He said, "My brothers have acted deceitfully like a wadi, like the torrents of wadis which vanish, which are turbid because of ice and into which the snow melts. When they become waterless, they are silent. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. The paths of their course wind along. They go up into nothing and perish. The caravans of Tema looked. The travelers of Sheba hoped for them. They were disappointed, for they had trusted. They came there and were confounded." Now, just stop there. Just a few points to make here before we move on. First of all, note Job's reference to his friends as brothers. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but this moniker of brother, and in fact brothers and sisters, is something that has been going on since antiquity. This is not a church thing. It's not just in the church that we refer to one another as brothers and sisters. In fact, in the earliest annals of human history, those of the same religious persuasions, often referred to each other as brothers and sisters. And this is true not just within the Judeo-Christian realm. It was even true among the pagans. Even today, Muslims also refer to fellow congregants as brother and sister, and so on and so forth. I just thought it was very interesting that we see this as early on, as we do here in what Job writes. Anyway, Job accuses these brothers, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. He accuses them of acting deceitfully like a wadi. A wadi? What's a wadi? A wadi is a ravine or a valley of sorts through which, during the rainy season, water would travel. And these wadis were well known among travelers. They would actually plan their course of travel to stay nearest known wadis. Why? Because you never knew really when the rainy season was happening in various parts of the known world at the time. So chances are, as you travel, especially across the wilderness, you're going to find enough water for your camels, your mules, your oxen, and even for yourself in these wadis. But the thing about these wadis, as Job points out, is that one minute the wadi might be flowing. One minute there might be a torrent of water going through, and the next minute it's dry. One minute it's turbid. That simply means cloudy. Turbid usually refers to the sediment that's stirred up in the water. It makes it either milky or opaque, right? As it's normally clear, when the water stirs up the sediment, it turns turbid. This usually happened when the ice was melting and flowing, and the snow. When they become dry, they're silent. When it's hot, it's as if they were never there to begin with. And where do these wadis go as they wind along the countryside? Well, the confusing thing is they actually go nowhere. They kind of go until they don't, until the land just flattens out. You know, we have a lot of that sort of thing here in Texas. I don't know if you've noticed that, but how many times you've been driving up and down the highways out in rural Texas and you see, for example, Woman Hollering Creek? Or anybody ever seen that one? Yeah, right. Or you might come across another creek or another creek. And most of the time you look down and you're like, that's a creek. There's no water in that creek. I mean, it's just a dry creek bed. That would be the same thing as a wadi, because when the rainy season comes, it's not unusual for those creeks to overflow their banks. It's not unusual when rain happens, torrential rain in this area, those formerly dry creek beds just are rushing with water. Now, where do these creek beds go? Well, sometimes they go nowhere. Sometimes because of agriculture and because of urban sprawl, they just end up stopping because someone's plowed the land up and made fields and stuff like this. So it's the same thing as what Job's describing here. Wadis were completely unreliable and sometimes deceitful. You'd look and it might look like there's great hope to find a puddle at the end of one, and there's nothing. It just runs out. And so he's referring to his friends as being like those wadis. These are the type of friends, quote unquote, that one would possibly do better without. These are the types of friends who were unreliable, unpredictable, just as the wadis were. These are what we refer to as fair weather friends. The fair weather friend is great when things are going well. The fair weather friend is great when the friendship benefits them in some tangible way. But the minute something happens to disrupt the status quo, whenever a friend needs something, especially something of real value, the fair weather friend simply vanishes, much like the wadi. Here Job likens himself to the travelers in the caravans of Tema and Sheba who, having hoped for refreshment, were disappointed, confounded when the water they had trusted would be there wasn't there after all. In the same way, Job had hoped and trusted that his three friends had actually come to refresh him, to sustain him in his troubles. But all he got was what? Veiled accusations, judgmentalism, suspicion, scorn, ridicule. This is what he's referring to when he says in verse 21, "Indeed, you have now become such. You see a terror and are afraid." Now, why would Job's friends consider him a terror and a cause for fear? Listen to Gill here. Job's friends were afraid of the righteous judgments of God, taking these calamities to be such, and fearing the same or the like should fall on them, should they keep him company, or however they should patronize and defend him, and afraid also of being too near him, lest his breath and the smell of him should be infectious, and they should catch a distemper from him, or lest he should be expensive and troublesome to them. That's really sad, isn't it? When you see a friend who's at their worst, and that's either mentally, psychologically, physically, your response shouldn't be revulsion. Your response shouldn't be a fear that you might catch what they have. Your response shouldn't be that you're put off by their appearance or the way they smell even or any of those external factors. Your response should be one of a tried and true friend. One who's there through thick and thin. It's almost like the marriage vows that are so common and yet so commonplace. When we marry our spouses, we promise before God and everyone present that we are with them to have and to hold till death do us part. Come sickness, come health, in wealth, in poverty. I think we would do well to reflect on those same vows toward our friends. I think the world is full of, especially with social media, things like Facebook and TikTok and Instagram and where people actually count among their friends those who provide them with the most likes. We've got a completely distorted way of looking at friendships these days. And I see it all over the place. When I ask people, how many really close friends do you have? Very few people will tell me that they have that many close friends. And you know, I know I'm going to sound like the old guy again. But I'm telling you, before the advent of cell phones, before the advent of tablets and social media, you know what social media looked like, kids? This was the only social media we had. And it involved real people engaging with other real people face to face and enjoying one another's company. If you don't believe what I'm saying, go to a restaurant and just sit there and watch people. What do you see most of the time when you go to a restaurant today? You'll see a table with 10 people at the table. And 8 of the 10 Oh, yeah, please, more tea. It's so true. The average dinner table in families today, including Christian families, has everyone sitting around the table doing their own thing on social media or entertaining themselves or taking, you know, the dreaded selfie. There's much to be said about the loss of real friends and the value of real friends. Friends who will be with you in the trenches. Friends who really don't care what you look like or smell like. They're going to be with you come what may, if they're true friends. Let me just
ask you. What kind of friend are you? What kind of friend are you? You know, your main source of friendship should be what? The church. Should it not? And yet, the problem persists, and I don't see it really being solved anytime soon, because I've been preaching about it for 20 years now. But the problem persists when someone, it's announced that someone is in the hospital, they're not well, they're... How many people, we ask them, how many people have come to see you during this particular season of need? And the standard answer every time is, not many. Not many. Is that what kind of friend you are? Can't take time out of your busy schedule to go see somebody who's struggling? Who needs you like nothing else? People who really themselves don't have that many friends outside of the body of Christ. What kind of friend are you? Can your brothers and sisters in this place count on you when things aren't going as swimmingly as they might have imagined? Or are you frightened and tempted to run away when you discover that you're among an imperfect, struggling, and sometimes broken people? Does your love for the brethren mirror the kind of love that Paul advocates for in 1 Corinthians 13? You know, we talk about 1 Corinthians 13 largely in the context of Valentine's Day or when people are getting engaged, when they're getting married. And we like to talk about love when it, you know, manifests itself in those ways. But what if I were to tell you that what Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 13 is the kind of love that's to be characteristic of the body of Christ every day, all the time, without fail? Let's read it again. I want you to ask yourself, do I love like this? Just verses 4 through 7, 1 Corinthians 13. Most of us balk at the first phrase, right? Love is patient. Well, I blew that test, right? Love is kind. It's not jealous. Love does not brag. It's not arrogant. Does not act unbecomingly. It doesn't seek its own. Is not provoked. Does not take into account a wrong suffered. Does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. This love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. As Paul said in the previous verses, it doesn't matter how blessed you may consider yourself to be in terms of spiritual giftedness, whether you're able to know all mysteries and have all knowledge, whether you have faith enough to move mountains, whether you're the greatest philanthropist the world's ever known, if you don't have this kind of love, it will profit you nothing. And again, I'm not afraid to be the old guy who, based upon my being a believer for this year, 50 years, my pastoral ministry of 32 years, I've learned a thing or two about culture, about people, about generational trends within the local church. And I think also with the advent of social media, with the advent of modern technology, I think what we see in the church in alarming measures is so much angst so much anxiety, so much anger. Now, there's a place and time for all of those things. Solomon teaches us that in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. But without love as one's overarching and guiding principle, none of those things are of any real value. Let everything that we do be done in love. Job's friends could have benefited from that understanding, could they have not? I mean, they would have done well to, instead of berating Job, instead of prejudging him, instead of coming alongside, assuming that they know what he's going through and what he's done and all the rest, they would have benefited, as I told Steve today, they would have been better off sticking with the tactic that they began with by just sitting there with their mouth shut. They would have done better just to sit and love on him. Just with that simple reminder. Job, look, we're not here to judge you. We're not here to offer you unsolicited advice. We're here because we love you. Imagine what the church at large would be like if that was our primary motive. Just to love each other. Not just to tolerate each other. There's a big difference. If you tolerate your brothers and sisters in this place, you've got a long way to go. Because we're commanded to love one another. By this, the world will know that you belong to me, if you love one another. What Job needed was true friends. Friends who would tell him the truth, yes, but in a way that would be constructive and not destructive. Job continues in verses 22 and 23 asking, have I said, give me something, or offer a bribe for me from your wealth, or deliver me from the hand of the adversary, or redeem me from the hand of the tyrants? In effect, what Job is asking them is basically, did I ask you guys to come here? No, you've come uninvited. Now, your motives are probably noble and commendable, but now that you're here, you could do a little better in your approach. Because I've not asked you here. I've not asked you for money. I've not asked you to help me get out of my predicament. I didn't ask you to go out and hunt down those who attacked me and took my possessions. In fact, I've never asked you for anything. This is why Job goes on to say in verses 24 and 25a, teach me, and I will be silent. Show me how I have erred. How painful are honest words. Now stop there. Some of you might say, well, wait a minute. That's exactly what Eliphaz attempted to do. It's not, though. That's not what Eliphaz attempted to do. There's a huge difference between teaching Job what he needed to know on the basis of known truth, even if the truth hurt, as long as we stay in the realm of facts, right? As long as we stay in the realm of scriptural truth, it might hurt, but the person will at least know that it's not you doing the hurting. The Word of God will hurt. People have commented to me over the years about how a particular passage that I preached cut them to the quick. And I'm very quick to say, well, it wasn't me though, right? No, it wasn't you. It was the Word that cut me to the quick. Oh, okay. That's fine. Truth does hurt. But there's a huge difference, again, between teaching Job what he needed to know on the basis of truth and simply speculating about what might be the source of his issues and then chastising him on the basis of that speculation, which is what Eliphaz had done. Job, I suspect that you've done something to become askew in your relationship with God. So whatever that is, you need to take care of that. And Job's like, where'd you get that idea? And Eliphaz responds, well, I've seen it in other men. I've seen it happen time and time again. The only reason anybody ever suffers to the extent that you're suffering is because they are great sinners. You see the mistake that Eliphaz makes? I would have been behind Job, looking at Eliphaz. Kind of like Pastor John does me on occasion. Right? And I love him for it. Sometimes I let my mouth get the better of me, and John's back there going. Job says, if you've got some important truth to impart to me, I'm all ears. Show me definitively and truthfully. Show me how I've erred. And I'll learn from it, and I'll adjust my behavior accordingly. Quietly and humbly. He then says in verse 25b and 26, but what does your argument prove? Do you intend to reprove my words when the words of one in despair belong to the wind? That's a really fascinating take by Job. It's both fascinating and insightful. Job's admitting here that much of what he said in response to his suffering was just that, a response to suffering. As I pointed out in our last study, whenever we hit our thumb with a hammer, there's no telling what's going to come out of our mouth. Do we mean it when it comes out of our mouth? Not usually. Women, again, some of you who had especially hard labors, you understand that you probably said things or at least thought things that were not on the holier side of things, right? That's just a reaction to suffering. And we need to cut Job some slack. Look how he's suffering. And that's all Job's saying. Look at me. I say things that are really to be accounted as nothing but dust in the wind. In other words, my words are not to be used against me as indicative of normal behavior or habitual behavior. For Eliphaz to have responded so eloquently, so accusingly, so harshly and judgmentally, and by the way, long-windedly, I mean two chapters. For him to have responded to what Job admitted were uncharacteristically rash words spoken out of intense suffering, that's not what Job needed to hear. And again, he just says, just give it to me straight. Tell me the truth. Point out where I have made a mistake, because I'm listening. He goes on in verse 27 to say, you would even cast lots for the orphans and barter over your friend. Now, if you're reading the King James Version, it says something totally different. It actually says, yea, ye overwhelm the fatherless and ye dig a pit for your friend. I mean, why does the New American Standard and other translations replace dig a pit for your friend with barter over your friend? That's very easily explained. The Hebrew word used here can either mean dig or barter. It was used interchangeably in a way that would have been readily recognizable, you know, among the Hebrews. And before we get too down on the Hebrew language, I mean, think about the English language. I've said it before. Only in English can you have a bear bearing a bearing. Right? I mean, it all sounds the same, and sometimes the words are even spelled the same, but they mean something completely different in the context. So we got to give the translators a little bit of slack here. Both things are true, though, right? What Job's actually saying here, I'm not going to get into all the linguistics, but what he's saying to his friends is that by all appearances, they were so pitiless toward his own predicament that he wouldn't put it past them to cast lots for the children of a debtor who was unable to pay his debts or to sell a so-called friend into service to another. That's how you're treating me right now. You'd just as soon sell me off. He then says in verses 28 through 30, and this is where it really comes into sharper focus. Now please look at me. And see if I lie to your face. Desist now. Let there be no injustice. Even desist. My righteousness is yet in it. Is there injustice on my tongue? Cannot my palate discern calamities? Basically, Job wants his friends to understand that everything he has said concerning his suffering to this point was not untrue or unjust. If they would just look at him, they could tell that he wasn't lying, and he believed that if they'd just stop and listen to what he had to say, he could vindicate himself. He could prove himself to be righteous. When he asks rhetorically, cannot my palate discern calamities? He's simply saying, look, I'm not so far gone that I can't still discern right and wrong, true and false, sincere and hypocritical, just or unjust. I know what I'm doing. I'm fully aware that the things I'm saying are born out of my pain, but they're true nonetheless. I've not cursed God. I've only cursed the day of my conception and the day of my birth. As any man might do. When you're in that much pain, you might very well say, Lord, I wish I'd never been born. That's not calling God's wisdom into question, necessarily. It's just a way of saying, my suffering is so intense. I'd rather not be here right now. And the only reason I am here right now is because I was born into this world. Oh, would it be that we could go back and just blot out my own conception and birth? Then I wouldn't be suffering the way I'm suffering. Again, perfectly human reaction. And how did Job's friends respond? Well, apparently they desisted, and as he asked, and then they listened to what he had to say. And what was that? Well, this brings us to verse 1 of chapter 7. Job asks, is not man forced to labor on earth, and are not his days like the days of a hired man? As a slave who pants for the shade, and as a hired man who eagerly waits for his wages, so am I allotted with months of vanity, and nights of trouble are appointed me. This is easy enough to understand. Every man on earth is allotted a specific number of days. Every person who has ever lived has lived and died on God's perfect timetable. You're not going to live a moment longer than God intends for you to live, nor are you going to die a moment sooner than God intends for you to die. So at the end of the day, whatever my God ordains is right, including the time of my birth, the duration of my life, and the time of my death. Job understood this. He understood this well. In his own case, this meant that God had appointed to him months of vanity and nights of trouble. Now, certainly he enjoyed, for a good portion of his life, he enjoyed the blessings of God. He was a very prosperous man. He was a righteous man. Now, though, it seemed as though those days were over. Continuing in verse 4, he says, when I lie down, I say, when shall I rise? But the night continues, and I'm continually tossing until dawn. Some of you can relate to that, can't you? You ever been really sick? I don't care what the sickness is, but you've just been in a position where you can't sleep, you know, or maybe even it's just psychological. Maybe you're just really anxious, worried, sick about this, that, or the other thing. And the sun goes down and, you know, it's always worse at night, is it not? Sun goes down and you think to yourself, now what do I do? The whole world's sleeping. Here I am tossing and turning, worrying, and the daylight can't come soon enough. Because things get better during the daytime, don't they? If you've ever been to Alaska during the winter months, John and Kara certainly understand this. During the winter months, sometimes, especially the closer you get near the Arctic Circle, you might not have but an hour, 2 hours worth of daylight during the day. The rest of the time, it's pitch black. It's dark outside. Now, it makes up for it in the summer, because in the summer, I mean, you can set a tee time at the golf course for 9 o'clock at night and play a full 18 holes, and it doesn't ever really get dark enough to matter. But in places like Alaska, northern Canada, up around the Arctic Circle, there's a known disease called SAD, seasonal affective disorder. And people buy these really elaborate lamps to simulate the sun, and they have to, you know, a lot of people just get really depressed during this time. Why is that? It's because science has long known that There's a direct correlation between moods and the amount of sunlight we are afforded. The darker it is, the more depressing things get. Now, I don't really understand that because I'm what is known as a pluviophile, which means I really love dark, cloudy, rainy weather. A lot of people, rainy, dark, you know, what's the old Carpenter song? Rainy days and Mondays always get me down, right? No, rainy days. Mondays, yeah, Mondays. But rainy days, I love them, right? But not everybody's like that. The dark can really depress people. Imagine being Job. Job lays there all night in his condition. And what was his condition? Well, verses 5 and 6. My flesh is clothed with worms and a crust of dirt. My skin hardens and runs. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and come to an end without hope. Now notice he says the nights are interminable. They go on forever, but the days, they just fly past. Why? Again, because the nighttime had a profound effect on his psyche, his ability to recover mentally, at least for a period of time. We've already talked about all the boils that Job had all over his body, these itching, oozing sores that were unbearably painful on their own. But now add into the mix these worms. This is probably a reference to maggots. When you're oozing, these boils are oozing pus and blood and serum, and you know, the maggots get in there. By the way, the maggots are the most helpful thing that the worms were the most beneficial thing for Job at this point. Why? Because maggots eat infected flesh. He didn't know that. And I'm not sure I would appreciate that. Right? Anybody getting queasy right about now? Yeah. I mean, when he said, look at me. Look at me and try to love me. That was a tall order. Here he is, crusted over, dirty, filthy. He says, the worms. Not only that, as one commentator said, the idea in the whole passage is that of one who is dead while he lives. That is, one who is undergoing putrefaction before he's buried. As the Septuagint renders this passage, Job is saying, my body swarms with the putrefaction of worms, and I moisten the clods of earth with the ichor, the pus and blood of ulcers. And it's because of this that Job says, my days, that is his remaining days on earth, are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and come to an end without hope. In his current predicament, Job assumed that he was running out of time. He had no hope whatsoever that he might be restored to his former manner of life. This is a pitiful, pitiful case. And so I hope you understand that Job is in such a situation as to elicit anyone's pity, not to be the subject of scorn and ridicule, not to be chastised for unknown sins. Again, I have to bring it full circle and ask you, is that the kind of friend you are? Can you love one another through thick and thin? Come what may, can you actually put your money where your mouth is and love people the way you're commanded to love them? I fear that even many professing believers have a conditional love. I'll love you as long as you satisfy me. I love you as long as you are good to me. I will love you as long as fill in the blank. True Christian love says, I love you, full stop. I love you with the same quality of love with which we have all been loved by Christ. Again, I hope that's convicting, as convicting to you as it was to me. This is what Job longs for. This is what Job needs. This is what all of us need. Now, let me just be careful to say, love does not mean acceptance of all things. Had Job been guilty of sins, he's like, lay it on me. If I've erred in any way, if you can substantiate that by truth, then tell me, because I can grow from that point. As iron sharpens iron, so does the countenance of one man sharpen the countenance of another. It's not always easy to hear the truth or to tell other people the truth. But if it's done in love, it's always beneficial. That's all Job's asking. Give me a fair shot. We would do well to remember to do that with one another as well. Right? Well, Lord willing, we're going to resume at verse 7 until